Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is Inside the Fed, a former governor speaks out on policy issues with Robert Heller. Mr. Heller is former governor of the Federal Reserve Board, former president Visa USA, and author of The Unlikely Governor. And with that, please welcome Mr. Heller.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for a kind introduction. I'm really pleased that there are so many good friends of mine. I want to say old friends. Yes, they are old, but for many years you have been my friends, and they've come from far away, and much appreciate that you all showed up here today. The program was first advertised as The Unlikely Governor, the book that I wrote not too long ago. And it basically recounts my life history. But then we changed the title because there's so much happening in the financial system right now. We changed the title to talk about current events and what the Federal Reserve is up to. But let me just start with two very brief pictures from my early youth. I grew up in Cologne, Germany, a town of about 750,000 people. So it's exactly the same size of San Francisco. And at the end of the war, there were 30,000 people left in the town. We had gone away from Cologne, like most of those other people. They weren't all killed. But when we returned at the end of the war, that was our house there on the left. That's my room, actually, the one with the big hole that you see on the top. And while the bombing occurred, my mother and I, we were hiding in this cave that you see on the right side, which is halfway up a mountain called the Drachenfels, which means the Dragon's Rock. That's the famous place where Siegfried defeated the dragon. So every little child in Europe knows about that mountain, and it's the most climbed mountain in the entire world. And halfway up the mountain there was that cave, and I had a little bed with red checkered cloth, and it was just around the entrance as you go in. When you read the book, you'll see that it wasn't quite as romantic as I remembered it to be. But nevertheless, it helped us survive the end of the war. And then the Americans came, and those were exciting days too, because for the first time in our life, we got chocolate, we got chewing gum, things that no little German girl and boy ever heard of. But today, we'll turn towards a more serious topic, policymaking at the Fed and the economic outlook. And people always ask me, you know, how did you get to the Fed? Well, from Germany, I came over with my girlfriend. We spent a year in the Midwest in college. And after that, I went to Berkeley. And then one disaster after the other followed. I went to Berkeley, and immediately the student riots broke out. Later on, it was recalled, re-christened the free speech movement. From Berkeley, I went to the international, to UCLA, teach there first, a couple of years. And as soon as I got there, the Watts riots broke out. The economics department itself was bombed. And so things hadn't changed much from World War II, I figured. I was actually a happy camper there, but eventually left for the International Monetary Fund, and immediately the world monetary system collapsed because Nixon took the United States off the gold standard. After the IMF, I came to Bank of America, and I see three, four of my colleagues over there. Thank you very much for coming. Those were exciting days. When I joined Bank of America, the stock was at 25. When I left Bank of America, the stock was at 6. But the good thing about all these disasters happening around was that, you know, while Mr. Clausen, Mr. Armacost, Mr. Prussia, they were all focused on the big problems. So the little guys like me got to do a lot of fun stuff. We ran around, gave speeches all over the place. And on one of those trips, I was in Japan, and in the middle of the night, suddenly the phone rings. So sleepily, I pick it up. Wouldn't do that anymore, but in those days, I was polite. I picked up the phone, and it says, "This is the White House calling, And I thought, geez, one of your friends playing a trick on you or something like that. And the very polite lady immediately said, wait a minute, you know, I'll put Don Regan on the phone. And as you may remember, he was President Reagan's chief of staff. So here was Don Regan saying, would you be interested in having a job at the, on the Federal Reserve Board? I was still sleeping. I still thought, my God, they're really trying to play a trick on you. But thank God I said, well, yes. And with that, he hung up, and that was it. So I was sitting in the middle of the night in Japan wondering what was going to happen next. Well, pretty soon the FBI was checking me out, and we had to show up for Senate hearings. I got confirmed 92-0, something you should try these days. Impossible, I would say. A very good friend of mine has been waiting for his Senate hearings for well over a year now, and he still hasn't been scheduled. Anyhow, I was on the road to Washington, and President Reagan welcomes me here to the Washington scene. I can't say to the White House because there's a separation between the White House, the administration, and the Federal Reserve, which is an independent agency, as you well know. And a couple of days later, I took my oath of office. And here you see the next disaster in my life. I was never a governor, but nobody knows that. Just look at the picture very carefully. Raise your right hand and put your left hand on the Bible. It doesn't look to me like I ever took the oath of office. But nobody noticed, so I was a governor. So now let's start with the fun part. Here are the main purposes and functions of the Federal Reserve. First of all, to conduct monetary policy. We all know that. Second, to engage in bank supervision and regulation, and we know that. There's a new purpose, that's maintain the stability of the financial system, something very important, which I'll talk about later. And fourth, the Federal Reserve provides the backbone to the nation's payment system. Now, if we zero in on monetary policy, the Federal Reserve Act actually says there are three things the Federal Reserve should be doing. Provide for maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate interest rates. And because there are three things, the Fed obviously calls that the dual mandate. I don't know. Maybe they can't count to three, you know. But those are the goals that Congress has charged the Federal Reserve with. So today, well, we want to talk about it. What are the first of all, the Federal Reserve's inflation target? Second, was quantitative easing a success? Should the Fed normalize rates now? And what will happen when interest rates go up? And finally, a few words on the Federal Reserve's precarious interest rate capital structure. So let's dive in. First of all, the 2% inflation target that the Federal Reserve has. Well, Congress says the Federal Reserve policy shall be oriented towards maintaining stable prices. Now, stable prices, 2% increase in the price level every single year? Not in my book, and if you look it up in Webster. Paul Volcker, who I had the honor to serve with first, he really focused on getting price stability accomplished. Volcker inherited over 10% inflation. So any inflation decrease was a great thing in his book, and he would have been the happiest camper in the world if you would have told him that one of these days there would be zero price inflation or price stability. So he was definitely a defender of total price stability. Then came Chairman Greenspan, and I served a couple of years with him. And Greenspan, in typical Greenspan speak, he would say, well, I want inflation so low that it is no factor in economic decision making. And the board pressed him. Well, does that mean zero? Does that mean two? Well, you know, not a factor in the decision making. That's the way he weaseled out of it. At that time already, when he was the chairman, Janet Yellen, who is now the chairwoman, she very strongly pushed for a 2% inflation target at that time. And Greenspan wouldn't really have anything of it. So nothing came of it. But then Bernanke became the new chairman, and Janet Yellen was the vice chairwoman. And Bernanke went for the 2% inflation target, and Janet Yellen enthusiastically supported that 2% inflation target. Now, what does it mean to have 2% inflation? 2% inflation means that you are doubling the price level every 35 years. In 70 years, the dollar will be worth only a quarter. So I would argue, don't have a specific number, not a 2% target. And you'll never hit that 2% target anyhow. Either it's just a little bit above or it's just a little bit below. So why not be happy as soon as the inflation rate is between 0 and 2%? And then you can sit back and relax. You'll have a much easier life, and the country will have less inflation, and you get closer to zero, and you will not have this continued devaluation of the U.S. dollar. Here is why the battle against inflation is so important. Look at the left graph, and you can't see, down at the bottom, you cannot see the years very well. At the beginning, it is 1960. And here come the 70s. And you see inflation going up. And here's 79, 80, 81. And inflation is over 10%, right, at that level. So that's the moment when Paul Volcker was appointed by President Carter, incidentally, and he was tasked with the getting inflation down again, and he did, at the cost of two recessions in a row. And if you look at this chart here carefully, and I hope you got good eyesight, every single time inflation kicks up, there is also a recession that follows. So inflation goes up here, that little point there, and the shaded area represents a recession. Here's inflation picking up again, and you have another recession follows. Here's the Fed, the episode I just talked about, and inflation follows, recession follows inflation, and so it goes on. So let's be careful wishing increases in inflation, because undoubtedly there will be a new recession following them. At the moment, the Federal Reserve's 2% inflation target has essentially been achieved. I show you two measures of inflation here. The blue line that fluctuates around a lot is the actual inflation rate. And you see it is about 1.75% here at the present time. So slightly below the 2% target that the Federal Reserve has set for itself. There's a dotted line, and that is the core inflation rate, the one without the volatile elements of food prices and energy prices, mainly oil. And so that fluctuates around an awful lot more, and depending on harvests. And here you see the recent drop in oil prices, reducing inflation close to zero. And then now it's kicking up again. So now it's at about 1.75%, just a tad below. So one measure is a little bit above, one measure is a little bit below. The Federal Reserve obviously picks the lower measure, so it looks like it hasn't achieved its target. But basically, we are there at that 2% target. Our current unemployment rate, I don't understand why it has all this just happened when here online somehow all the formatting has disappeared. All the, you know, the interest rates and unemployment rates, there were labels on these axes here before. But nevertheless, we can understand it. As of this morning, unemployment is at 4.7%, right there. That little downtick that you barely see there, that is today's unemployment rate. The last 2 or 3 months, it was at 5%. And nobody I know of in the economic profession will argue that you can get the unemployment rate lower than 4%, 4.7%. That is it as far as normal conditions are concerned. And long-term interest rate, the third goal of the Federal Reserve, are exceedingly low, 1.7% for the Treasury 10-year bill. It's about as low as we have experienced it. So what's the Fed scorecard? The Fed basically has met its targets. 2% inflation, we are right on. Unemployment rate, superb, low. Long-term interest rates, superb. They're extremely low. The mission accomplished. I resisted the temptation to put President Bush's picture there with mission accomplished. Because you remember all what happened to him after he said that, right? There was a lot of stuff, let's call it that way, still going on in Iraq, and there's a lot of stuff still going on in the U.S. economy. And so let's look a little bit more at the U.S. economy, what other things are happening at the present time. But as we do that, QE, quantitative easing, was the big thing that Chairman Bernanke introduced for the first time in U.S. history to get the U.S. going again. Remember 2008, 2009, the banking crisis had happened. We were in a recession. The economy was almost coming to a standstill. So Bernanke said, okay, let's buy a lot of government securities. Let's buy a lot of mortgage-backed securities. And that was called quantitative easing. And he bought about $2 trillion worth of this stuff. And that is that increase here in the size of the total balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, total assets of the Federal Reserve being shown on the vertical axis, obviously time on the horizontal one. And then a couple of years later, it hadn't worked. So they said, oh, let's do some more. Hasn't worked. You know, that's a good idea. Let's, if you're in a hole, dig some more, right? So that's QE2 here, that increase. And then he said, well, maybe it was too little. And that became QE3. And now the total balance sheet of the Federal Reserve is about $4.5 trillion, when beforehand here it was about $800 billion. So the balance sheet has basically quintupled, blown up the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. So did quantitative easing increase the growth rate? In the left graph here, I show the growth rates that we have just seen in quantitative easing. And that here is about 10%, 20%, 30%, 40% increases in the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. So we have enormous increase in the Federal Reserve assets. What effect does it have on the money supply? Because that is what is really driving economic spending. People got more money in their pockets, then they spend more money. And that's what they really wanted to achieve. You can barely see it down here. Just a little tiny hump, you know, 5% or something in that neighborhood. Same thing happens again. QE2, again, a little of an increase, but not much. QE3, totally ineffective. By now, people have become accustomed to these shenanigans, and they say, well, you know, just quantitative easing. What else will happen? So the effect on the money supply, which will be the transmission mechanism for this buying of assets by the Federal Reserve barely noticeable. On the right, I show GDP growth, gross domestic product. How much are we producing every year? And look at the dotted line here. It's barely above zero. It's 2% on average. The dots are pretty thick, but it's not zero. It's about 2% above zero. So the Federal Reserve, with all these things, with all these stimulus, has done very little to actually influence national product or economic growth. So how do we judge the success of quantitative easing? The initial impetus, I think, was great. It helped to resolve the liquidity crisis that we were in 2008 and 2009. And by 2010, the liquidity of the banking system, the liquidity of the overall economy had been restored. Liquidity, you know, that's the lifeblood of the economy. That's what you need in order to keep the economic machine pumping and circulating. So the initial liquidity injection prevented a market meltdown. But then QE2, QE3, basically ineffective. And the economic studies that have been done on it, they all show that as well. And you look at Europe. You look at Japan. They are doing all quantitative easing to the gazoo. And what's happening? Nothing. Japan is still sitting mired in the, you know, extremely low growth, and in Europe, you have the same. So quantitative easing is not the way to go about it. Bernanke has a new plan. You know, now he wants to throw money out of helicopters. It's not a new plan. Actually, it's an old plan. He devised it when he was a graduate student at MIT, and that's why during his graduate school days he had a nickname of Helicopter Ben. Because he was advocating, well, to stimulate the economy, let's just throw money out, then you don't have all these other problems. Well, Federal Reserve didn't throw money out of the helicopters, but quantitative easing was his way to try to do it. Old central bankers have a lot of wisdom. And there are two things that Paul Volcker used to say quite often to us. Number one, take a few puffs on his cigar, and he'd say, well, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And number two, you can't push on a string. So those two things we really should keep in mind. Turning to the current situation, has the Federal Reserve painted itself into a corner? Let's look at that. The country is clearly awash in liquidity. All the banks have high reserve balances, about $2.5 trillion in reserves the banks have at the Federal Reserve. And all that money is just sitting out there waiting to be lent. The corporations have $500-600 billion in cash balances. And I'm counting not near cash, I'm just counting the actual demand deposits that they're holding at the banks here. So corporations have a lot of cash sitting around. Corporate profits are exceedingly high here, an all-time high. That's how high the profits were before the crisis in the good old days of 2006, 2007. Now, corporate profits are almost double that amount. But new investment growth is very slow. New investment here growing only at about 5% per year, and that isn't much to push the economy forward. Well, what do these low rates, what's the effect of all these low rates? First of all, if you got money in your savings account, you're earning 1/10 or 20 basis points on it, 1/4%, and that's about it. That's not enough money to retire on. So what do people do? They reach for risky assets. So you go into the stock market. If you go into the stock market, that's one of the reasons why the stock market is doing so well these days, because people have no other place to put their money. But there are two parts of the financial sector that are very much depending on the yields of bonds, and that is insurance companies, life insurance companies especially, and pension funds. If you talk to people at CalPERS, where some of you may have your money invested, they are assuming that they get 7.5% in earnings every single year. Well, if treasury bonds are making 1.75%, the portfolios of these insurance companies and pension funds in the late 90s, they were almost 100% invested in bonds. Now they have maybe 10% in bonds. The rest is in stocks, hedge funds, real estate, and other things. And the question is, when you are ready to retire, I'm looking at the young ones in the back of the room there, when you're ready to retire, will those markets be up or will they be down? Will those insurance companies and pension funds have the money to pay your pension? And if interest rates go up, I doubt it. Who will pay out the pension funds? Well, if you are in a public pension funds, they will say, this is our legal obligation, increase taxes. The private pension funds, there isn't anybody there standing to catch you, so to say. So things may get very tough in these very important sectors of the economy as you look 5-10 years ahead. I would conclude that it is time to normalize policy. The Fed has attained its short-term goals. The QE was ineffective. Rates have to be normalized. And there is a long-term threat to financial stability. The Federal Reserve itself, in the last minutes they have published, say that neither monetary nor fiscal policy is well positioned to help the economy withstand substantial adverse shocks. Fiscal policy and monetary policy are not in the right spot, and that includes the Fed's own monetary policy. There's an interesting thing you can read, which is sort of a little bit of a weather vane, a forecast of what is likely to happen. As you know, the Federal Reserve has 12 districts, and they make recommendations to the Federal Reserve Board on the discount rate, or what is now called the primary credit rate, discount rate recommendations. And four of them, Cleveland, Richmond, Kansas City, and San Francisco, are in favor of increasing the rate as of April. So, you know, they are arguing for it. Here, I say, just do it. On the left, if you don't see it, there's this young lady in front of a computer. So she says, do you think the Fed will raise interest rates this month or what? Kids are worried about it. What's the Fed worried about? The Fed is worried about the market's throwing a temper tantrum. And you see what happens if temper. As a parent of, a grandparent of a bunch of kids, I'd say ignore the temper tantrums. If you pay attention to them, makes it even worse. What's holding back the economy? Ever-increasing regulation. Moses had 10 commandments that he asked his people to obey. Anybody here in this room has ever obeyed all of them? Please raise your right hand. No one. 10 was difficult enough. Now we have 4,500 federal criminal law. And since the recession, we have added 20,000 new rules and regulations. There are ever more regulatory agencies, Sarbanes-Oxley, Dodd-Frank, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I'm sure you know all the other people. The last one I was actually a member of, FFIEC. Anybody knows what that stands for? We used to joke, yeah, if you know what it means, you're one of the board members. Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council. To me, it looks like Gulliver being tied down by the Lilliputians, and that's what the regulations do to us these days. You think that was a joke? This is the actual picture that the General Accounting Office produced 2 months ago of the financial services regulatory structure. And at the top, you see the regulators, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, Office of Control of the Currency, the Credit Union Administration, blah, 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 on and on. And at the bottom, you see the institutions, banks, insurance companies, and on and on and on. And those are the different agencies that are responsible for it. Look at the banks. There are about 6, 7 regulators that the banks have to deal with all the time. It's insanity. The regulators, they have now 2 different groups that, you know, that FFIEC, as well as the Financial Oversight Stability Council, that's supposed to coordinate the regulators. How can one human being actually follow all those rules? It's impossible. Here is the lessons that we have learned in the past and we are about to forget. Here again is a chart that starts in 1960. About 1960. And there it goes on. And it shows you the number of bank failures that have taken place in particular years. I think you can all identify the years when I was the chairman of bank supervision and regulation. 86 to 89. That was 2,000 banks failed. You remember in those days, middle 80s, the entire SNL industry was wiped out. And what were the 2 lessons learned? First of all, we had unit banks. We had small banks. You couldn't branch interstate. And we took away those restrictions of the McFadden Act. So we need geographic diversification. Second, we need product diversification. And we got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, which prevented banks to offer securities and vice versa. In 2008, only integrated banks survived. Every single investment bank failed, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, that was not also a bank. The other investment banks, Merrill Lynch, were bought up by Bank of America, and other banks merged. So only integrated banks survived. And what do we hear our presidential candidates on both sides of the aisle calling for right now? Let's get at the banks and have separation of, get them downsized, have banks not be involved in the securities business and vice versa and so on. So not a good idea, I would argue. Low interest rates have also caused bank formation, new bank formation to stall. Here you see the Fed funds rate and the new charters to banks granted. Almost nothing since the financial crisis. Only 3 new banks have been formed in the last 5 years. 3 new banks. Used to be 100 every year. And all the additional things. What would I suggest? 1 regulator for each institution, have strong capital requirements. We can talk about the 10% rule. We're running a little bit out of time. And eliminate the micromanagement by the regulators of the banks. Furthermore, there's something that I really don't like about the Federal Reserve. And the same is true about the Environmental Protection Agency and other lot of federal agencies. The basic tenet of our constitutional system is the separation of power. There's one group called the legislature that makes the laws. There's one group called the administration that executes the laws. And there's another group called the legal tribes adjudicates it. The Federal Reserve Board does all three of them. One day you sit there and you say, okay, let's make a new rule. The next day you sit there, oh, this bank has violated the rule. A week later you sit there, that bank has, the banker should be barred from banking or some other penalty imposed on it. Can't send him to jail. That goes through an administrative law judge. But you can bar the person from banking for life. Pretty good penalty, you know, if you think about it, suddenly your livelihood is gone. I don't like that, but that's... What will happen when interest rates rise? Last year, the Federal Reserve transmitted $117 billion in profits or earnings to the U.S. Treasury. Everything gets turned over to the Fed. As the Fed increases the rates, they have to pay more on these deposits, on these excess reserves that the Federal Reserve has. Last year, they paid about $7 billion on it. A rough calculation shows if interest rates rise to 3%, they have to pay $70 billion to the banks in interest. So the result will be that the Federal Reserve will run large annual deficits. Not enough. Their balance sheet, they hold $4.5 trillion in assets. What happens to a bond that you're holding when interest rates go up? If rates go up, value of a bond goes down. If rates go up by 2%, the value of the bond goes down by 17% of a 10-year bond. If rates go up by 3%, they go down by 24%. 24% of all that money that the Federal Reserve, of all those assets the Federal Reserve has, $4.5 trillion. So if rates go up 2%, somewhere between $600 and $900 billion in balance sheet losses. Add that to the annual losses, and you're talking about some real money. The Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Reserve banks, will lose $1 trillion. $1 trillion. Gone. Does it matter? Well, you ask your favorite congressman what they will say when the Federal Reserve loses $1 trillion. They'll say, whose money was that? Was it ours? Was it yours? So the Federal Reserve at the moment is the least well-capitalized bank in the country. Last year, the administration, Congress, passed the FAST Act. It sounds like something you want to do at, you know, I don't know what images it conjures up, you know. Yeah. Anyhow, it's called the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act. And Section 23,200 of that act actually says the Federal Reserve shall turn over all its capital in excess of $10 billion to the U.S. Treasury. And so when they turned over the $117 billion, that allowed the president to stand there and to give a speech and say, the lowest deficit in the last 8 years. Lowest deficit in the last 8 years. Because he got one-fourth of that was Federal Reserve, one-time payment. Now, think of the next president, whoever it is, Bernie Sanders, Trump, Hillary, to say, just lost $1 trillion. Wouldn't go over all that well. How the Federal Reserve cope with this political pressure that we'll be building up? So, this is the end. Monetary policy. Short-term goals all attained. Long-term problems are building. In bank supervision regulation, too much detailed regulation hampers new bank formation, hampers economic growth. The stability of the financial system. Watch out for the pension funds. Watch out for the insurance companies. Imbalances are building. And the Federal Reserve itself, like I said before, may face enormous problems. Thank you very much. And like we said, most of that is in the book, not the last 2 or 3 weeks, not today's unemployment rate, but a lot of interesting stuff. Thank you very much. And here's Kevin.
Thank you, Dr. Heller. I realized I was calling him Mr. Heller. I should have been Dr. Heller.
Yeah.
But I'd like to remind our audience listening at home today, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley, chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program today with Dr. Robert Heller, a former governor, speaks on current policy issues. I would now like to turn it over to some of our audience members for questions, and I will start right here.
What effect does the big outflow of cash to China have on everything you said?
Well, complicated question. It's worth another full lecture. I'd like to come back. But basically, the question is the outflow of cash, you call it. So that means it's the trade deficit, right? So it means they have more employment. They are doing the producing, the manufacturing that we are no longer doing. They're doing more of that. But because they are earning all this money from the United States, they got to put it somewhere. Where are they going to put it? The money has to be earning dollars, and they got to invest dollars back someplace. And that logical place is the United States. The Chinese are holding about $3 trillion worth U.S. Government securities, U.S. debt. Just a little footnote. What do you think is going to happen to the governor of the Central Bank of China when he gets called in by his boss and he says, oh, yeah, you know, I just lost a big pile of money, you know, the more inflation in the United States, the bond prices went up, so our portfolio is worth less. China, they do things that we don't do to our Federal Reserve governors and people like that. But so China is investing in the United States. Not all of it is in government securities. A lot of it is regular investment. They are buying houses and buildings in San Francisco. They are buying factories, doing things like that, and that is good for them in the long run. So does that answer your question? Or you want to follow up?
Slightly.
Okay.
Well, I was thinking of how all these fluctuations in our system are affected by that, not what China is doing with their money, but our own system being bled out money from it. You're saying it all comes back, or a lot of it comes back to our system, and so there's no net effect?
There is a net effect, a big net effect. You know, like I said, the two net effects. First of all, what happens to employment and manufacturing? We are producing less, they are producing more. Clear about that. You know, my wife was tucked in the granddaughter in bed, and she says, Grandma, she says, everything I own, all my toys, all my clothes, they've all been made in China. Those people must be very busy. Yeah. Yes. They are very busy, and they are creating new jobs. Well, we have a tough time growing fast. China is growing at 6-7%. We are growing at 2%, and that explains part of the difference. And then second, they're investing here, and that is money that we either have to pay back or on which they're earning dividends. And you know, like anybody who owns some shares in IBM or General Motors or whatever it is, that's the long-term problem or issue.
Right here.
Yeah.
We'll get to you in a minute.
Right,
a question right here.
It appears that I fully agree with you with the too many regulations have really caused tremendous problem. But would you also tell us lack of regulations or what happened in 2008? What would have been, or what are the really fundamental cause of that crash?
Okay, 2008 versus having more regulation. Since that happened, since 2008, like I said, 20,000 new rules and regulations have been put on the federal books alone. not counting the state and local and cities and so on, if you're trying to build a house or whatever it is. So we got lots of rules and regulations, so many that it's, in my view, it's holding down the economy. Now, did the crash happen because of lack of regulation? What was the real cause of the crash? A lot of people would argue, and you know, a lot of causes, but a lot of people would argue that housing and ill-advised mortgages were a big part of it. Who was calling for these ill-advised mortgages? Well, no politician said, I want you to make an ill-advised mortgage. But they said, make a mortgage without this, without documentation, you know, and so on it went. The enormous push to lend to people who really couldn't afford it. And then eventually those subprime mortgages, as they were called, not prime mortgages, subprime mortgages, they got into trouble. And as a result, that was the spark that set off the crisis of 2008-2009. What would have helped prevent the crisis or make it smaller? More bank capital. Like I said, I'm strongly in favor of having more bank capital. And the way I would do it is, it's not the required capital that for the banks that can be used in these moments of difficulty. If you, let's say, set required bank capital at 10%, and then you say, okay, you get one, and that would be a bank, let's give them a grade of F. If they have 11%, you give them a grade of D. If they have 12%, you give them a C. If they have 13%, you give them a B. And if they have 14% capital, you give them an A. At the moment, the big banks, by the way, have 12%, the big banks on average. So it's pretty good. So on average, they would be getting a C. If they get a little bit more, maybe they get an A. But if they had that much capital instead of, I don't know the exact number, 2-3% of capital that they had in 2008, we would have been able to weather that storm much better. And the investment banks were particularly badly capitalized. Lehman Brothers had a leverage ratio of 30-1. And, you know, that is just not enough. Now, one more little footnote there. All these investment banks, or most of them, they used to be private partnerships. And so the partner's money, his own money, was on the line. Now they're public companies. The guy in charge gets paid $10 million a year. And if he makes more profits, he gets paid $11 or $12 million a year. But his own money is not on the line. If he gets thrown out, that's the problem. Thank you. If your own money is on the hook, you will behave more carefully. Kevin.
Dr. Heller, if you look at the shall I say, landscape today, the litigation by the SEC and others have continued to mount. And in Dodd-Frank, I think we have something like 400-plus lawsuits. And again, Arizona, where I come from, part of the 9th District, we have 7 years now before we can actually get into court to solve some of these things. So what are we going to do about this litigious society we've created where everybody's on that thing? And can we solve that if we come up with a new mindset?
Well, if you can solve that, I vote for you for president. It's a litigious society. And, you know, one guy will – there are some legal reforms you can engage in. I think we're getting a little bit astray here from our main topic. But, for instance, in most European countries, the loser in a lawsuit pays the law fees not only for himself but also for the party that wins the lawsuit. So, as a result – people think twice before they file a lawsuit, and especially a frivolous lawsuit like we often see. Nowadays, we have these lawsuits, you know, they say, okay, well, let's file a lawsuit, and if we win, we win big. If we don't, you know, well, just our lawyer's time. He has nothing to do anyhow, you know, in court. And, you know, that's the way these frivolous lawsuits get filed. And we have done everything possible to actually encourage them take class action suits, you know. Lawsuits in states like Texas and California have gone drastically down on medical malpractice because it is capped. And so you have less of that. Other states have still enormous lawsuits. So legal reform, reforming the system is an important part of getting a more rational one. Yes, sir.
What is the actual duration of the $5.5 trillion? Well, it's not 10 years, is it?
No. They kept the $4.5 trillion in assets that the Federal Reserve has. I don't know the exact duration of it. Can't answer your question. But it is, I think it's less than 10 years.
Yeah,
it is.
The problem may not be that big in terms of interest rate increases.
I grant you that. Instead of $700 billion in losses, they may have only $500 billion in losses.
Okay. And secondly...
By the way, not to interrupt, but there are a lot of people right now that are encouraging the Fed to lengthen the portfolio because they say, oh, you know, why, and the government to lengthen the portfolio. You know, then you have, at the moment, you have low interest rates, so you're paying less.
Yeah.
The government good, the Fed would be bad. Okay. Yes, sir. Sorry.
Now, from what I can see, one of the problems with the economy and the growth of the economy is very low productivity and a secular decline in the percentage of the working age population in the actual workforce, which suggests almost like secular stagnation, a Larry Summers sort of idea. What is your thinking on that, you know, in terms of growth, and what does that mean in terms of normality for our economy?
Well, I think the regulation is the one that is really the bat, the gorilla in the room, you know, if you can't talk about gorillas these days. Better not. So what was your first point? The
productivity.
Right. The labor force participation rate is fairly low at the present time, and that clearly plays also into that new low unemployment rate of 4.7%. But, you know, people can't be forced to work, at least under current laws and regulations, so they have to be willing to work. They have to say, I'm looking for a job. And they're looking for a job only if they get more compensation, adequate compensation. You can't even argue that having high unemployment benefits reduces the incentive to work, so the labor force participation rate goes down. So there are a lot of things that play into that result. And why is productivity itself growing so slow? Because there isn't much new investment. It's one of the key things. There's very little investment. Look at all the companies that have all their money sitting around. Apple, or have you, Google, you know, billions of dollars on the balance sheet. But they're not really investing. If they do anything, they are spending the money maybe on an acquisition. But they're holding on to the cash and bringing it back to this country in order to enable them to investment, then they have to pay the high taxes, so they rather let it sit in the Bahamas. There are a lot of reasons why investment is low. And the regulations, the rules and regulations are just killing new job formation. Right now, I'm working with a couple of guys who are trying to get a new company going. In the United States, to get the regulatory permits only would cost us roughly $10 million. Regulatory, it's in the financial sector. Every single state has to give us a license, $10 million. So in all likelihood, we're going to go to Canada. In Canada, $50,000 for a license, you're in business. There's a difference between having this insane regulatory apparatus and not having it. Our yacht club over in Belvedere, 2010, we started to look for a permit to have a little extension of our main building. We're still looking. 6 years later, we are still in the regulatory process. Well, that adds to the costs enormously. So those are reasons why the economy isn't going as fast as it could.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. Good afternoon. My name is Carla Mays. I run a civic innovation firm here in San Francisco dealing with innovation economy. My question to you is all about this automation. And, you know, we have all these companies, these startups and everything, but they don't last long. And they don't, you know, we're talking about no employees, fixed assets. How's that going to, how does that play into what you've talked about this afternoon?
Well, interesting question. Obviously, San Francisco, the reason why we have a vibrant economy in San Francisco is because of all the little startups, right? So a couple of guys and girls are sitting in a room and they come up with another great idea and they say, we're the next Apple, we're the next Google, and let's go and let's invest. And that is all for the good. But these technology startups, they also have one feature that I think has some influence on the, for instance, high income inequality that we have in the country. You know, given the internet, you can, it's basically a winner-take-all economy. In the old days, you know, every little town, I went to college in Iowa. On Saturday afternoon, the bandstand was in the middle, you know, and then they played and stuff like that. There were little theaters. Nowadays, what do the kids listen to? Not to the bandstand, but to Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift makes $130 million or something like that a year. Great for her. But that is the, you know, all these people who were sitting there with their fiddles and who are singing in the little bandstand in every single town across the Midwest, they all don't have a job anymore. Taylor Swift has the money. It's an income inequality thing that happens. And that is something that technology has enabled. It's not unique to the United States. The same thing was true. East Germany, before the wall came down, every little town had a theater. Every little town had an orchestra. And all those people were employed. By the state, no less. And now, you know, they have one guy who stands up front there and he makes a lot of money. Thank you.
Dr. Heller, I'd like, if you don't mind, to go back to what I consider the Federal Reserve time bond, that $4.5 trillion. Even with the short-term ladder going to 10 years, it takes away another piece of equipment from the Fed. The low interest rates take away equipment in terms of dealing with the bubble where we may or may not see. How do they get out of it reasonably without buying it forever by going to 30 years?
That's the $64,000 question, John, obviously. How does the Fed get out of it? And they don't know how they're going to get out of it. At the moment, they're reinvesting. When any one of those bonds matures, they are reinvesting it. They're rolling it over. Well, are they going to do that forever? You can't. The only thing, I mean, you know, if you really want to paint the devil on the wall, the only thing that gets you out of it is enormous inflation. And I can prove that to you because in my own pocket, I always carry enough money to pay off, being a prudent man, to pay off the entire debt. Here is a banknote that says $100 trillion. It's from Zimbabwe, but $100 trillion. That's enough. This little piece of paper is enough to pay off the entire U.S. debt five times over. Well, that's one way out. But what has it done to Zimbabwe? That's not the way we want to go. And as soon as we get back on a responsible course of no inflation, that makes the problem, then we have to face the problem. And that is a short-term difficulty. And you look at the political arena, who is willing to do that? It was, you know, during the 1970s, we had stagflation. We had inflation, and it was increasing all the time. And we also had high unemployment, and we had low growth. Stagflation. Then finally, Volcker stood up, and he's a tall guy, and he said, okay, we'll deal with this. The Federal Reserve people mailed two-by-fours because the entire construction industry was out of a job. And so he bit the bullet. And like I said, Carter appointed him, Reagan backed him, and it was a big political issue at that time. But we got through it, and since then we have benefited from ever lower inflation. You don't want to inflate it away. You want to deal with the problem. Freeze it in place at least. Don't add to it.
Good. Well, I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program today has been Dr. Robert Heller, a former governor, speaks on current policy issues. Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for only one more question right now. I'm going to turn it over to someone right here, and then I will come back to Dr. Heller for last remarks.
Bob, what is the likelihood that this Federal Reserve System will keep interest rates so low that we may see negative short-term interest rates in our markets as we have in Japan and parts of Europe?
Good question. Can we get to negative rates? I sure hope not. If we get, first of all, the negative rates didn't do anything good for Japan, didn't do anything good for Europe. So why go there? There are some people who will argue negative rates will stimulate economic activity, increase growth. I read a German magazine not too long ago, and there was an ad for a Mercedes automobile. 40,000 euros. I'm making up the numbers a little bit. Then it said, if you finance it over 3 years, subtract $3,000, so price 37,000. They want to sell the car. If you want to give us the money now, you pay 40. If you give us the money a couple of years from now, you have to pay only 37. Good thing or not? Well, in Europe, the insurance companies and the pension funds, they are on the verge of dying. And that will be the next disaster that Europe will hit. You talk about spending your way out of money. Look at Greece. What happens there? Higher inflation. Look at Venezuela. The country is a shambles. Brazil. Higher inflation doesn't get you anywhere. And every single time, I showed you here, that we had increases in inflation rate, a recession followed. So I'm not in favor of negative interest rates, and I've never heard anybody at the Federal Reserve advocating negative interest rates. I hope we don't go there.
Thank you, Dr. Heller. I'd like to remind everyone listening at home, this is Inside the Fed. A former governor speaks on policy issues with Dr. Robert Heller. Dr. Heller is former governor of the Federal Reserve Board, former president of Visa USA, and author of The Unlikely Governor that we have for sale immediately afterwards. I would like to ask you one final question. I enjoyed reading your book. How do you feel that your journey to Berkeley in the 60s and visiting Vietnam and all of the things that you grew up with, and how does that lead to your current thinking on economic policy?
Excellent question. Actually, it wasn't Berkeley. It was when I started teaching at UCLA, and I actually had to explain to the students what was happening, what was going on. At that time, sort of, I had the light bulb go on, and there were superb teachers at my time at UCLA, including Milton Friedman. Tom Sowell, by the way, was my office mate, right the office next to me. You may have heard of him. And that's when I started to see that all the flim-flam really didn't work too well, and that you really had to go back to solid principles, sound money, no deficits for the federal government in order to produce a healthy long-term economy.
Thank you, Dr. Heller. And with that, I would like to close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion. Our program is adjourned.